Richard pushed the packs out ahead and started inching his way forward. He tried not to think about the rough ceiling of rock, only a hand width above his back. He knew it would become narrower before they got out. The shelf of rock sloped upward to the right slightly, into the dark. The light was to the left and down. It looked like the easiest way out was to go straight toward the opening. It wasn't far. They had to go instead up into the darkness and around the narrowing of the cleft in order to get around to a place where they could fit through. Forcing himself to go up into the dark, where it felt tighter and more closed in, rather than toward the light of the opening, felt wrong. But he had already scouted the route, and he knew that his feelings were wrong about this. As he moved deeper into the darkness, going around the impassable area in the center of the chamber, he reached the spot where the rock above lowered. Advancing in further, it came down until it pressed against his back. He knew it wasn't far, not more than a dozen feet, but without being able to take a full breath, the cramped passage was daunting. Richard pushed the packs ahead as he wriggled and wormed his way along. He had to push with the toes of his boots and with his fingers finding any purchase available, pull his chest through, force himself to make headway into the dark, away from the light. Jensen's fingers had an iron grip on his ankle. That was fine with Richard, because he could then help pull her through with him. He wanted to be able to help pull her through when she reached the spot that would compress her chest. And then she suddenly let go of his ankle. Chapter 33. Off behind him, Richard could hear Jensen scrambling away. "Jensen, what's going on? What are you doing?" She was crying out, whining in terror, as she bolted toward the light at the opening. "Jensen?" Richard called out to her. "Don't go that way. Stay with me." Wedged in as he was, he couldn't easily turn to see. He forced himself ahead, crabbing sideways, trying to spot her. Jensen was clamoring toward the light, ignoring him as he called to her. Kaylin wormed her way up to him. "What's she doing?" "She's trying to get out. She sees the opening, the light, and won't listen." Richard shoved the packs and frantically worked his way ahead, moving into the area beyond the tight spot, to where it was open enough that he could at last get a full breath and almost get up on his hands and knees. Jensen screamed. Richard could see her clawing frantically at the rock, but she wasn't making any headway. In a frenzy of effort, she tried to push herself forward, but instead, she'd slipped sideways farther down the slope, wedging herself in tighter. Each exaggerated, panting breath as she strained and stretched ratcheted her in deeper. Richard called to her, trying to get her to listen, to do as he said. In her desperation, she wasn't responding to any of his instructions. She saw the opening, wanted out, and would not listen to him. Fast as he could, Richard scrambled through the darkness and around toward the opening, guiding Kaylin, Owen, Kara, and Tom through the only way he knew they could make it. Kaylin held tight to his ankle, and he could hear by the panting of effort that the rest of them were all following in a line behind her. Jensen screamed in terror. She struggled madly but couldn't move. Wedged in as she was, with rock compressing her rib cage top and bottom, it was becoming difficult for her to breathe. "Jensen, take a slow breath. Slow down," Richard called to her as he scurried around toward the opening. "Breathe slow. Breathe." Richard finally reached the opening. He emerged from the dark crevasse, squinting in the sudden light. On his knees, he leaned in and helped pull Kaylin out. Betty scrambled out, somehow having passed the rest of the people. As Owen and then Kara clambered out of the opening, Richard pulled the baldric over his head and handed his sword to Kaylin. Tom called out that he was going back in to try to reach Jensen. As soon as the rest were safely out, Richard dove back into the fissure. Head first, on his hands and knees, he scuttled into the dark. He could see that Tom, from his angle of approach, had no chance to get to her. "Tom, I'll get her." "I can reach her," the man said, even as he was getting himself wedged tight. "No, you can't," Richard said in a stern tone. "Wishing won't make it so. You'll just get yourself stuck. Listen to me. Back out now, or your weight will help push you downhill and get you stuck so hard that we won't be able to get you out. Back up now, while you're still able to. Go. Let me get her. Tom watched Richard moving around behind him, and then, making a face that showed how unhappy he was to be doing it, he started pushing himself back up into the darkness, where there was, a few precious inches, more room that would let him make it back out. Richard worked his way through the tight spot and then moved down the slope so that he wouldn't be facing downhill as he tried to help Jensen and possibly wedge himself in tighter than he wanted. If he wasn't careful, he would do the same thing Tom had been about to do. Down in the darkness, Jensen cried in panic. Richard, flat on his belly, wiggled and snaked his way deeper, all the while moving to his left, down the pitch in the shelf of rock. Jensen, breathe. I'm coming. It's all right.
Richard, please don't leave me here. Richard.
Richard spoke in a calm, quiet voice as he moved around behind her down into the tighter part of the cave. I'm not going to leave you. You'll be fine. Just wait for me.
Richard, I can't move.
She grunted with effort.
I can't breathe. The ceiling is coming down. It's moving. I can feel it coming down. It's squeezing me. Please help me. Richard, please don't leave me.
You're fine, Jensen. The ceiling isn't moving. You're just stuck. I'll have you out in a minute. Even as he worked his way into the low spot, trying to get up close behind her, she was still struggling to move forward, making it worse. There was no way she could go forward and make it out. As she kept struggling, though, she was slowly slipping deeper down the slope and with every frantic breath wedging herself in tighter. He could hear how desperately she was trying to breathe, to draw each shallow breath against the immovable compression of rock. Finally, all the way back around her, Richard started pushing himself in the way she'd gone. She had gone into a narrow channel that closed down on the uphill side of her, so there could be no moving her sideways up the slope. He had to get her to back up the way she'd gone in. He had to get her to go away from the light and back into what she feared. The roof of rock scraped against his back, making it difficult to draw a full breath. He had to take shallow breaths as he moved deeper. The farther he went, he could not even breathe that deeply. The need for air, for a deep breath, made the pain of the poison feel like knives twisting in his ribs. Arms stretched forward, Richard used his boots to force himself in deeper, trying to ignore his own rising sense of panic. He reasoned with himself that there were others who knew where he was, that he wasn't alone. With the powerful feeling that a mountain of rock was crushing him, reasoning with himself was difficult, especially when the shallow split of rock he was pressed into hardly let him get any air as it was, and he was desperately working himself deeper trying to reach Jensen. He knew that he had to help pull her out of where she was stuck, or she would die there.
"Richard," she cried, "it hurts. I can't breathe. I'm stuck. Dear spirits, I can't breathe. Please, Richard, I'm scared."
Richard stretched, trying to reach her ankle. It was too far away. He had to turn his head sideways to advance. Both ears scraped against rock. He wiggled, inching in tighter, even though his better judgment was telling him that he was already in trouble. "Jensen, please, I need you to help me. I need you to push back with your hands, push back toward me."
"No, I have to get out. I'm almost there."
"No, you're not almost there. You can't make it that way. You have to trust me, Jensen. You've got to push back so I can reach you."
"No, please, I want out. I want out."
"I'll get you out, I promise. Just push back so I can reach you." With her blocking the light, he couldn't tell if she was doing as he instructed or not. He squirmed in another inch, then another. His head was almost stuck. He couldn't imagine how she had gotten in as far as she had.
"Jensen, push back."
His voice was strained. He couldn't get enough of a breath to talk and to breathe too. His fingers stretched forward, reaching, stretching, reaching. His lungs burned for air. He just wanted to take a deep breath. He desperately needed a breath. Not being able to draw one was not only painful but frightening. His heartbeat pounded in his ears. As high as they were in the mountains, the air was already thin, and it was difficult to get enough air the way it was. Limited to taking shallow breaths was making him lightheaded. If he didn't get back to where he could breathe soon, the two of them were going to be forever in this terrible place. The tips of Richard's fingers caught the edge of the sole of Jensen's boot. He couldn't get a good grip on her foot, though.
"Push back,"
he whispered into the dark. It was all he could do to keep his own panic in check.
"Jensen, do as I say. Push back. Do it."
Jensen's boot moved back into his hand. He snatched it in a tighter grip and immediately worked his way back a few inches. Pulling with all his might, he strained to drag her back with him. Try as he might, she wouldn't budge. She was either stuck tight or was fighting to go forward.
"Push back," he whispered again. "Use your hands, Jensen. Push back toward me. Push!"
She was sobbing and crying something he couldn't make out. Richard wedged his boots, top and bottom, in the tight cleft, and then pulled with all his might. His arm shook with the effort. He managed to draw her back a few inches. He wiggled himself back an equal distance and pulled again. With agonizing effort, he slowly, painstakingly started drawing her out of the dead end she had fled into in a panicked attempt to get out. At times she tried to squirm back toward the light. Richard, the rock compressing him tight, kept a firm hold of her boot and muscled her back yet more, not allowing her to take back any of the distance he gained. He couldn't straighten his head. That made it more difficult to use his muscles to move the both of them. With his head lying on the right, he reached back with his left arm and gripped a small lip of rock in the ceiling, using it to help haul them back. With his right arm stretched forward and holding her by the boot, he drew her back inch by inch. As he reached back again for another handhold, Richard saw something not far to his left down the slope, wedged where the rock narrowed. At first he thought it was a rock. As he struggled to draw Jensen back, he stared at the thing, also stuck in the rock. He reached to the side and touched it. It was smooth and didn't feel at all like the granite. As he began to make good progress backward, he stretched to the side and managed to get his fingers around the thing. He pulled it to his side and continued to wiggle back. With great relief, he was finally back far enough to where he was able to get enough air. He lay still for a time, just catching his breath. Almost as much as air, though, he wanted out. While he talked to Jensen, distracting her with instructions she only intermittently followed, he began forcing her back and to the right, where there was more room. Finally, he managed to move up beside her and seize her wrist. Once he had her, he started moving her back up the slope, into the darkness, into the tight place that he knew was the only true way out. With him up beside her, she was a little more cooperative. All the while, he kept reassuring her, "This is the way, Jensen. This is the way. I'll not leave you. I'll get you out. This is the way. Just come with me, and we'll be out in a few minutes." When they worked their way up into the dark, tight spot, she began struggling again, trying again to scramble for the light of the opening, but he was blocking her way. He stayed close at her side as he kept them both moving forward. She seemed to find strength in his constant assurances and his firm grip on her wrist. He was not about to let her get away from him again. When they pushed through to the place where the roof rose up a bit, she started weeping with expectant joy. He knew the feeling. Once the ceiling rose up a foot or two, he hurried as fast as he could to get her back to the opening to the light. The others were waiting, right at the entrance, to help pull them out. Richard held the thing he'd retrieved under his left arm as he helped push Jensen out first. She rushed into Tom's waiting arms, but only until Richard crawled out and got to his feet. Then, crying with relief, Jensen fled into his arms, clinging to him for dear life.
"I'm so sorry,"
she said over and over as she cried.
"I'm so sorry, Richard. I was so afraid."
"I know," he comforted as he held her. He'd been in a similar situation before, where he thought he might never get himself out of such a terrifying place, so he did understand. In such a stressful circumstance where you feared you were about to die, it was easy to be overpowered by the blind need to escape, to live.
I feel so confused.
I don't like such tight places either, he said. I understand.
But I don't understand. I've never been afraid of places like that. Ever since I was very young, I've hid in tight little places. Such places always made me feel safe because no one could find me or get to me. When you spend your life running and hiding from someone like Darkin Rall, you come to appreciate small, dark, concealed places. I don't know what came over me. It was the strangest thing. It was like these thoughts that I wouldn't get out, that I couldn't breathe, that I would die, just started coming into my head. Feelings I've never had before just started to seep into me. They just seemed to overwhelm me. I've never done anything like that before.
Do you still feel these strange feelings?
Yes, she said as she wept. But they're starting to fade now that I'm out, now that it's over.
Everyone else had moved off a ways to give her the time she needed to set herself straight. They sat not far off, waiting, on an old log turned silver in the weather. Richard didn't try to rush her. He just held her and let her know she was safe.
I'm so sorry, Richard. I feel like such a fool.
No need. It's over now.
You kept your promise, she said through her tears.
Richard smiled, happy that he had. Owen, his face tense with worry, looked like he couldn't help himself from asking a question.
But Jensen, he asked as he stepped forward, why didn't you do magic to help yourself?
I can't do magic any more than you can.
He rubbed his palms on his hips.
You could if you let yourself. You are one who is able to touch magic.
Other people might be able to do magic, but I can't. I don't have any ability for it.
What others think is magic is only themselves tricking their senses and only blinds them to real magic. Our eyes blind us. Our senses deceive us, as I explained before. Only those who have never seen magic, only those who have never used, sensed, perceived it, only those who do not have any ability or facility for it can actually understand it, and therefore only they can be true practitioners of real magic. Magic must be based entirely on faith if it is to be real. You must believe, and then you can truly see. You are one who can do magic.
Richard and Jensen stared at the man.
Richard, Kalin said in an odd voice before he could say anything to Owen.
What's that?
Richard blinked at her.
What?
She pointed. That, there, under your arm. What is it?
Oh,
he said. Something I found wedged in the rock near Jensen, back in where she was stuck. In the dark, I couldn't tell what it was, other than it wasn't a rock. He pulled it out to have a look. It was a statue. A statue in his likeness, wearing his war wizard's outfit. The cape was fixed in place as it swirled to the side of the legs, making the base wider than the waist. The lower portion of the figure was a translucent amber color, and through it could be seen a falling trickle of sand that had nearly filled the bottom half. The statue was not all amber, though, as Kalin's had been. Near the middle, obscuring the narrowing where the sand dribbled through, the translucent amber of the bottom began darkening. The higher up the figure, the darker it became. The top, the shoulders and head, were as black as a night stone. A night stone was an underworld thing, and Richard remembered all too well what that wicked object had looked like. The top of the statue looked to be made of the same sinister material, all glossy and smooth and so black that it looked as if it might suck the light right out of the day. Richard's heart sank at seeing himself represented in such a way, as a talisman touched by death.
"She made it," Owen said,
shaking an accusatorial finger at Jensen, still sheltered under Richard's right arm.
"She made it with magic. I told you she could. She spun it of evil magic back in that cave when she wasn't thinking. The magic took over and came out of her then, when she wasn't thinking about how she couldn't do magic."
Owen didn't have any idea what he was talking about. This was not a statue Jensen made. This was the second warning beacon.
meant to warn the one who could seal the breach.
Lord Rawl?
Richard looked up. It was Kara's voice. She was standing off a ways, her back to them, looking up at a small spot of sky off through the trees. Jensen turned in his arms to see what had put the odd tone in Kara's voice. Holding his sister close, he stepped up behind Kara and peered up through the trees where she was looking. Through a thin area in the canopy of pine, he could see the rim of the mountain pass above them. Silhouetted against iron-gray clouds stealing past was something man-made. It looked like a huge statue sitting atop the pass. Chapter 34. Icy wind tore at Richard's and Kalen's clothes as they huddled close together at the edge of a thick stand of spruce trees. Low, ragged clouds raced by as if to escape the colossal, dark, swirling clouds building above them. Fat flakes of snow danced in the cold gusts. Richard's ears burned in the numbing cold.
"What do you think?"
Kalen asked. Richard shook his head. "I don't know." He glanced behind them, back into the shelter of the trees. "Oh, and are you sure you don't know what it is? You don't have any idea at all?" The roiling clouds made an ominous backdrop for the imposing statues sitting up on the ridge.
"No, Lord Rawl. I've never been here before. None of us ever traveled this route. I don't know what it could be, unless..."
His words trailed off into the moan of the wind.
"Unless what?"
Owen shrank back, twisting the button on his coat as he glanced to the moored Sith on the one side of him and Tom and Jensen on the other.
"There is a foretelling from the ones who gave us our name and protected us by sealing the pass. It is taught that when they gave our empire its name, they also told us that one day a savior would come to us."
Richard wanted to ask the man just what exactly it was he thought they needed saving from if they had lived in such an enlightened culture where they were safe from the unenlightened savages of the rest of the world. Instead, he asked a simpler question he thought Owen might be able to answer.
"So you think that maybe that's a statue of him, your savior?"
Owen fidgeted, his shoulders finally working into a shrug.
"He is not just a savior. The foretelling also says that he will destroy us."
Richard frowned at the man, hoping this was not going to be another of his convoluted beliefs.
"This savior of yours is going to destroy you. That makes no sense."
Owen was quick to agree.
"I know, no one understands it."
"Maybe it's meant to say that someone will come to save your people," Jensen suggested, "but he will fail, and so only end up destroying them in the attempt."
"Maybe."
Owen's face twisted with the displeasure of having to contemplate such an outcome.
"Maybe," Kara suggested in a grim tone, "it means this man will come and, after seeing your people, decide they aren't worth saving."
She leaned toward Owen and decide to destroy them instead. Owen, as he stared up at Kara, seemed to be considering her words as a real possibility, rather than the sarcasm Richard knew them to be.
"I don't think that is the meaning,"
Owen finally told her after earnest consideration. He turned back to Richard.
"The foretelling, as it has been taught to us, you see, says first that a man will come who will destroy us. It then goes on to say that he is the one who will save us. Your destroyer will come and he will redeem you," Owen quoted. "That is how we have been taught the words, how they were told to my people, when we were put here beyond this pass."
"Your destroyer will come and he will redeem you," Richard repeated.
He took a patient breath. "Whatever it originally said has probably been confused and all jumbled up as it has been passed down. It probably no longer resembles the original saying." Rather than disagree, as Richard expected, Owen nodded.
"Some believe, as you say, that over the time since we were protected and given our name, maybe the true words have been lost or confused. Others believe that it has been passed down intact and must have important meaning. Some believe that the foretelling was meant to say only that a savior will come.
Others think it means only that a destroyer will come."
"And what do you believe?" Richard asked.
Owen twiddled the button on his coat until Richard thought it might come off.
"I believe that the foretelling is meant to say that a destroyer will come, and I believe that he is this man Nicholas of the Order, and then that a savior will come and save us. I believe that man is you, Lord Rawl. Nicholas is our destroyer. You are our savior."
Richard knew from the book that prophecy didn't function with these people, with pillars of creation. "What your people think is a foretelling," Richard said, "is probably nothing more than an old adage that people have gotten mixed up." Owen held his ground, if hesitantly.
"We are taught that this is a foretelling. We are taught that those who named us told us this foretelling and that they wanted it passed down so all might know of it."
Richard sighed, the wind pulling out a long cloud of his breath.
"So, you think that up there is a statue of me, put there thousands of years ago by the ones who protected you behind the boundary? How would they know, long before I was born, what I would look like in order to make a statue of me?"
"The true reality knows everything that will be," Owen said by rote. He forced a half-smile as he shrugged again.
"After all, it made that little statue that you found look like you."
Unhappy to be reminded of that, Richard turned away from the man. The small figure had been made to look like him by magic tied to the boundary and possibly to a dead wizard in the underworld. Richard scanned the sky, the rocky slopes all around, the tree line. He didn't see any sign of life. The statue, they still couldn't quite make out what it was, sat distant up a treeless, rocky rise. It was yet quite a climb up to that rim of the pass, to that statue. Richard was not going to like it if it did indeed turn out to be a statue of him beneath the gathering gloom. He already didn't like it one bit that the second warning beacon was meant for him. It bound him to a responsibility, a duty he neither wanted nor could accomplish. He had no idea how to restore the seal on Bandekar. Zed had once created boundaries that were probably similar to the one that had been down here in the old world. But even Zed had used constructed magic he found in the keep. Such constructed spells had been created by ancient wizards with vast power and knowledge of such things. Zed had told him that there were no more such spells. Richard certainly had no idea how to call forth a spell that could create such a boundary. More to the point, he didn't see how it would do any good even if he knew how. What had really been freed from Bandekar when the boundary failed was the trait of being born without any trace of the gift. That was why they had all been banished here in the first place. The Imperial Order was already breeding women from Bandekar in order to breed the gift out of mankind. There was no telling how far that trait had already spread. Breeding the women, as it sounded like they were doing now, would gain them more children who were pristinely ungifted, children who would be indoctrinated in the teachings of the Order. When they started using the men for breeding, the number of such children would vastly increase. A woman could have a child every year. In the same time, a man could sire a great number of children bearing his pristinely ungifted trait. Despite the Order's creed of self-sacrifice, they had not yet, it would seem, been willing to sacrifice their women to such an undertaking. Raping the women in Bandekar and proclaiming it for the good of mankind was fine with the men of the Order. For the men ruling the Imperial Order to give over their own women to be bred, however, was quite another matter. Richard had no doubt that they eventually would start using their own women to this purpose, but that would come later. In the meantime, the Order would probably soon start using all the women captured and held as slaves for this purpose, breeding them to men from Bandekar. The Order's conquest of the New World would provide them with plenty more women for breeding stock. Whereas in ancient times, those in the New World tried to limit the trait from spreading in man, the Imperial Order would do whatever it could to accelerate it.
"Richard," Kaelin asked in a low voice so the others farther back in the trees wouldn't hear. "What do you think it means that the second warning beacon, the one for you, is turning black like the Night Stone? Do you think it means to show you the time you have left to get the antidote?"
Since he had only just found it, he hadn't given it much thought. Even so, he could interpret it only as a dire warning, The Night Stone was tied to the spirits of the dead, to the underworld. It could be, as Kalin suggested, that the darkening was meant to show him how the poison was taking him, and that he was running out of time. For a number of reasons, though, he didn't believe that was the explanation.
"I don't know for sure," he finally told her, "but I don't think it's a warning about the poison. I think that the way the statue is turning black is meant to represent materially how the gift is failing in me, how it's slowly beginning to kill me, how the underworld, the world of the dead, is slowly enshrouding me." Kalin's hand slipped up on his arm, a gesture of comfort as well as worry.
"That was my thought, too. I was hoping you would argue against it. This means that the gift might be more of a problem than the poison. If, after all, this dead wizard used the beacon to warn you about it."
Richard wondered if the statue up on the ridge of the pass would hold any answers. He certainly didn't have any. To make it up there and see, they would have to leave the shelter of the forest and travel out in the open. Richard turned and signaled the others forward.
"I don't think the races would be expecting us here," he said as they gathered around him. "If we really did manage to lose them, they won't know where we went, what direction. So they won't know to look for us here. I think we can make it up there without the races, and therefore Nicholas knowing."
"Besides," Tom said, "with those low clouds hugging most of the mountains, they may not be able to search."
"Maybe," Richard said.
It was getting late. In the distant mountains, a wolf howled. On another slope across a deep cleft in the mountains, a second wolf answered.
There would be more then, too.
Betty's ears perked toward the howls as she crowded against Jensen's legs.
"What if Nicholas uses something else?" Jensen asked.
Kara gripped the blonde braid lying over the front of her shoulder as she scanned the woods to the sides.
"Something else?"
Jensen pulled her cloak tighter around herself as the wind tried to lift it open.
"Well, if he can look through a race's eyes, then maybe he can look through the eyes of something else."
"You mean a wolf?" Kara asked. "You think that wolf you heard might be him?"
"I don't know,"
Jensen admitted.
"For that matter," Richard said, "if he can look through the black eyes of the races, maybe he could just as easily look through the eyes of a mouse."
Tom swiped his wind-blown blonde hair back from his forehead as he cast a wary glance at the sky.
"Why do you think he always seems to use the races, then?"
"Probably because they're better able to cover great distances," Richard said. "After all, he'd have a lot of trouble finding us with a mouse."
"More than that, though, I think he likes the imagery of being with such creatures, likes thinking of himself as being part of a powerful predator. He is, after all, hunting us."
"So you think we only have to worry about the races, then?" Jensen asked.
"I think he would prefer to watch through the races, but that isn't his end, only his means," Richard said. "He's after Kalin and me. Since getting us is his end, I think he will turn to whatever means he must if necessary. He very well might look through even the eyes of a mouse if it would help him get us."
"If his end is having you," Kara said, "then Owen is helping his ends by bringing you right to him." Richard couldn't argue with that. For the moment, though, he had to go along with Owen's wishes. Soon enough, Richard intended to start doing things his own way.
"For now," Richard said, "he's still trying to find us, so I expect that he will stick to the races since they can cover great distances. But since I've killed races with arrows, he must realize that we at least suspect someone is watching us through their eyes. As we get closer to him, I see no reason that in the future he might not use something else, so we won't know he's watching us."
Kalin looked to be alarmed by the idea.
"You mean something like a wolf, or, I don't know, maybe an owl?"
"Owl, pigeon, sparrow?"
"If I had to guess, then I'd guess that at least until he finds us, he will use a bird."
Kalin huddled close beside him, using his body to block the wind. They were up high enough in the mountains that they were just beginning to encounter snow. From what Richard had seen of the old world, it generally appeared too warm for snow. For there to be snow this time of year, it would only be in the most imposing of mountains. Richard gestured to the icy flakes swirling in the air.
"Owen, does it get cold in winter in Bandakar? Do you get snow?"
Winds come down from the north, following down our side of the mountains, I believe. In winter, it gets cold. Every couple of years, we get a bit of snow, but it does not last long. Usually in the winter, it rains more. I do not understand why it snows here now, when it is summer.
Because of the elevation, Richard answered idly as he studied the rising slopes to each side.
Higher yet, the snowpack was thick, and in places where the wind blew drifts into overhangs, it would be treacherous. Trying to cross such precipitous snow-covered slopes would be perilous at best. Fortunately, they were nearing the highest point they would have to climb to make it over the pass, so they wouldn't have to traverse heavy snow. The bitterly cold wind, though, was making them all miserable.
"I want to know what that thing is," Richard finally said, gesturing up at the statue on the rise. He looked around at the others to see if anyone objected. No one did.
"And I want to know why it's there."
"Do you think we should wait for dark?" Kara asked.
"Darkness will hide us better." Richard shook his head. "The races must be able to see pretty well in the dark. After all, that's when they hunt. If given a choice, I'd rather be in the open during the daylight, where I can see them coming."
Richard hooked his bow under his leg and bent it enough to attach the bowstring. He drew an arrow from the leather quiver over his shoulder and knocked it, holding it at rest against the bow with his left hand. He scanned the sky, checking the clouds and looking for any sign of the races. He wasn't entirely sure about the shadows among the trees, but the sky was clear of races.
"I think we'd better be on our way." Richard's gaze swept across all their faces first, making sure they were paying attention.
"Walk on the rocks if at all possible. I don't want to leave a trail behind in the snow that Nicholas could spot through the eyes of the races."
Nodding their understanding, they all followed after him, in single file, out onto the rocks. Owen, in front of the ever-watchful moored Sith, kept a wary eye toward the sky. Jensen and Betty watched the woods to the sides. In the strong gusts, they all hunched against the wind and the stinging bite of icy crystals hitting their faces. In the thin air, it was tiring climbing up the steep incline. Richard's legs burned with the effort. His lungs burned with the poison. By the look of the sheer walls of rock rising up into broken clouds to either side, Richard didn't see any way, other than the pass, for people to make it over the imposing mountains. At least not without a journey of tremendous difficulty, hardship, and probably a great loss of life. Even then, he wasn't really certain that it was even possible. In places, as they trudged up the edge of the steep rise, he could see back through gaps in the rock walls of the mountains, under the dark bottom of clouds, to sunlight beyond the pass. None of them spoke as they climbed. From time to time, they had to pause to catch their breath. They all kept an eye to the churning sky. Richard spotted a few small birds in the distance, but nothing of any size. As they approached the top, following a zigzagging course so they could more easily make it up without having to scale rock faces of jutting ledges, Richard caught glimpses of the statue sitting on a massive base of granite. From the high vantage point in the pass, he could now see that the rock on either side of the rise fell away in precipitous drops. The gorge at the bottom of either side dead-ended at vertical climbs of what would have to be thousands of feet. Whatever routes might have branched off lower down, they would have to converge before going up this rise. By the lay of the land, it became clear to him that this was the only way to make it through this entire section of the pass. He realized that anyone approaching Bandakar by this route would have to climb this ridge in the rise, and they would unavoidably come upon the monument. As he mounted the final cut between the snow-dusted boulders standing twice his height, Richard was able, at last, to take in the entire statue guarding the pass. And guarding the pass it was. This was a sentinel. The noble figure sitting atop a vast stone base was seated as he watchfully guarded the pass. In one hand, the figure casually held a sword at the ready, its point resting on the ground. He appeared to be wearing leather armor, with his cape resting over his lap. The vigilant pose of the sentinel gave it a resolute presence. The clear impression was that this figure was set to ward what was beyond.
The stone was worn by centuries of weather, but that weathering failed to wear away the power of the carving. This figure was carved, and it was placed with great purpose. That it was out in the middle of nowhere, at the summit of a mountain pass no longer traveled, and a trail possibly abandoned after this was set here, made it to Richard all the more arresting. He had carved stone, and he knew what had gone into this. It was not what he would call fine work, but it was powerfully executed. Just looking at it gave him goosebumps.
"At least it doesn't look like you," Kalin said.
At least there was that. But this thing, being there all alone for what very well might have been thousands of years, was worrisome. "What I'd like to know," Richard said to her, "is why this second beacon was down there, down the hill, in that cave, and not up here." Kalin shared a telling look with him.
"If Jensen hadn't done what she did, you would never have found it."
Richard walked around the base of the statue, searching for what he didn't know. Almost as soon as he started looking, he saw, on the front of the base, on the top of one of the decorative moldings, an odd void in the snow. It looked as if something had been sitting there, and had then been taken away. It was a track of sorts, a telltale. Richard thought the barren spot looked familiar. He pulled the warning beacon from his pack and checked the shape of the bottom. His thought confirmed. He placed the figure of himself in the void in the snow collected on the rim of the base. It was a perfect fit. The little figure had been here with this statue.
"How do you think it came to be down in the cave?" Kara asked in a suspicious voice.
"Maybe it fell," Jensen offered. "It's pretty windy up here. Maybe the wind blew it off and it tumbled down the hill." "And just managed to roll through the woods without being stopped by a tree, and then, neat as can be," Richard said, "roll right into the small opening of a cave, and then just happen to come to be stuck in the rock right near where you, by coincidence, ended up stuck. Stuck, I might add, in a terrifying place you aren't terrified of." Jensen blinked in wonder.
"When you put it like that..."
Standing at the crown of the pass in front of the statue right where the warning beacon would have rested, and now again rested, Richard could see that the spot held a commanding view of the approach to Bandekar. The mountains blocking off the view to either side were as formidable as anything he'd ever seen. The rise where the sentinel sat overlooked the approach into the pass back between those towering snow-capped peaks. As high as they were still only at the foothills of those mountains. The statue was not looking ahead, as might be expected of a guardian, but rather its unflinching gaze was fixed a little to the right. Richard thought that was a bit odd. He wondered if maybe it was meant to show this sentinel keeping a vigilant eye on everything, on every potential threat. Standing as he was, directly in front of the statue's base, in front of where the warning beacon sat, Richard looked to the right, in the direction the man in the statue was looking. He could see the approach of the pass up through the mountains. Farther out in the distance, he could see vast forests to the west, and beyond that, the low, barren mountains they had crossed. And he could see a gap in those mountains. The eyes of the man in the statue were resolutely fixed upon what Richard now saw. "Dear spirits," he whispered.
"What is it?" Kalin asked. "What do you see?"
"The pillars of creation." Chapter 35. Kalin, standing beside Richard, squinted into the distance. From the base of the statue, they had a commanding view of the approaches from the west. It seemed as if she could see half a world away, but she couldn't see what he saw.
"I can't see the pillars of creation," she said.
Richard leaned close, having her sight down his arm where he pointed. There. That darker depression in the expanse of flat ground. Richard's eyes were better at seeing distant things than were hers. It was all rather hazy-looking, being so far away. "You can recognize where it lies by the landmarks there." He pointed off to the right, and then a little to the left, and there. Those darker mountains in the distance, that are a little higher than the rest, have a unique shape.
They serve as good reference points so you can find things.
Now that you point them out, I can see the land where we traveled from. I recognize those mountains.
It seemed amazing, looking back on where they'd been, how high they were. She could see spread out into the distance the vast wasteland beyond the barren mountain range, and even if she couldn't make out the details of the dreadful place, she could see the darker depression in the valley. That depression she knew to be the Pillars of Creation.
"Owen," Richard asked, "how far is this pass from your men, the men who were hiding with you in the hills?"
Owen looked baffled by the question.
"But Lord Rall, I have never been up this portion of the pass before. I have never seen this statue. I have never been anywhere close to here before. It would be impossible for me to tell such a thing."
"Not impossible," Richard said. "If you know what your home is like, you should be able to recognize landmarks around it, just as I was able to look out to the west and see the route we've traveled to get here. Look around at those mountains back through the pass and see if you recognize anything."
Owen, looking skeptical, walked the rest of the way up behind the statue and peered off to the east. He stood in the wind for a time, staring. He pointed at a mountain in the distance through the pass.
"I think I know that place."
He sounded astonished.
"I know the shape of that mountain. It looks a little different from this spot, but I think it's the same place I know."
He shielded his eyes from the gusts of wind as he gazed to the east. He pointed again.
"And that place! I know that place, too!"
He rushed back to Richard.
"You are right, Lord Rall. I can see places I know."
He stared off then as he whispered to himself,
"I can tell where my home is, even though I've not been here, just by seeing places I know."
Richard had never seen anyone so astounded by something so simple.
"So," Richard finally prompted, "how far do you think your men are from here?"
Owen looked back over his shoulder.
"Through that low place, then around that slope coming from the right."
He turned back to Richard.
"We have been hiding in the land near where the seal on our empire used to be, where no one ever goes because it is near the place where death stalks near the pass. I would guess maybe a full day's steady walk from here."
He suddenly turned hesitant.
"But I am wrong to be confident of what my eyes tell me. I may just be seeing what my mind wants me to see. It may not be real."
Richard folded his arms and leaned back against the granite base of the statue as he gazed out toward the Pillars of Creation, ignoring Owen's doubt. Knowing Richard as she did, Kaylin imagined that he must be considering his options. Standing beside him, she was about to lean back against the stone of the statue's base, but instead paused to first brush the snow off from beside where the warning beacon rested. As she brushed the snow away, she saw that there were words carved in the top of the decorative molding.
"Richard, look at this."
He turned to see what she saw, and then started hurriedly brushing away more of the snow. The others crowded around, trying to see what was written in the stone of the statue's base. Kara, on the other side of Richard, ran her hand all the way to the end to clean off the entire ledge. Kaylin couldn't read it. It was in another language she didn't know, but thought she recognized.
"Hi, Daharan?" Kara asked.
Richard nodded his confirmation as he studied the words.
"This must be a very old dialect," he said, half to himself as he scrutinized it, trying to figure it out. "It's not just an old dialect, but one with which I'm not familiar, maybe because this is so distant a place."
"What does it say?" Jensen wanted to know as she peered around Richard between him and Kaylin. "Can you translate it?"
"It's difficult to work out," Richard mumbled.
He swiped his hair back with one hand as he ran the fingers of his other lightly over the words. He finally straightened and glanced up at Owen, standing to the side of the base watching. Everyone waited while Richard looked down at the words again.
"I'm not sure," he finally said.
"The phraseology is odd." He looked up at Kaylin. "I can't be sure. I've not seen Hai Daharan written this way before. I feel I should know what it says, but I can't quite get it."
Kalin didn't know if he really couldn't be sure, or if he didn't want to speak the translation in front of the others.
"Well, maybe if you think it over for a while, it might come to you," she offered, trying to give him a way of putting it off for the time being if he wanted to. Richard didn't take her offer. Instead, he tapped a finger to the words on the left of the warning beacon.
"This part is a little more clear to me. I think it says something like, 'Fear any breach of this seal to the Empire beyond.'"
He wiped a hand across his mouth as he considered the rest of the words.
"I'm not so sure about the rest of it," he finally said. "It seems to say, 'For beyond is evil, those who cannot see.'"
"Of course," Jensen muttered in angry comprehension. Richard raked his fingers back through his hair.
"I'm not at all sure I have it right. Something about it still doesn't make sense. I'm not sure I have it right."
"You have it perfectly right," Jensen said. "Those who cannot see magic. This was placed by the gifted who sealed those people away from the rest of the world because of how they were born."
Her fiery eyes filled with tears.
"Fear any breach of this seal to the Empire beyond, for beyond is evil? Those who cannot see magic?" "That's what it means. Those who cannot see magic."
No one argued with her. The only sound was the rush of the wind across the open ground. Richard spoke softly to her.
"I'm not sure that's it, Jen."
She folded her arms and turned away, glaring out toward the pillars of creation. Kalin could understand how she felt. Kalin knew what it was like to be shunned by almost everyone except those who were like you. Confessors were thought of as monsters by many people. Given the chance, Kalin was sure that much of the rest of humanity would be happy to seal her away for being a confessor. But just because she could understand how Jensen felt, that didn't mean Kalin thought the young woman was right. Jensen's anger at those who banished these people was justified, but her anger at Richard and the rest of them for having the same spark of the gift, which made them in that way the same, was not. Richard turned his attention to Owen.
"How many men do you have waiting in the hills for you to return?"
"Not quite 100.
Richard sighed in disappointment.
"Well, if that's all you have, then that's all you have. We'll have to see to getting more later.
For now, I want you to go get those men. Bring them here to me. We'll wait here for you to return. This will be our base, from where we work a plan to get the order out of Bandekar. We'll set up a camp down there, in those trees, where it's well protected." Owen looked down the incline to where Richard pointed, and then off toward his homeland. His confused frown returned to Richard.
"But Lord Rawl, it is you who must give us freedom. Why not just come with me to the men, if you want to see them? Because I think this will be a safer place than where they are now, where the Order probably knows they're hiding."
"But the Order does not know that there are men hiding or where they are."
"You're deluding yourselves. The men in the Order are brutal, but they aren't stupid."
"If they really know where the men are, then why hasn't the Order come to call them in?"
"They will," Richard said. "When it suits them, they will. Your men aren't a threat, so the men of the Order are in no hurry to expend any effort to capture them. Sooner or later they will, though, because they won't want anyone to think they can escape the Order's rule. I want your men away from there, to a place they've not been, here. I want the Order to think they're gone, to think they've run away, so they won't go after them."
"Well," Owen said, thinking it over, "I guess that would be all right."
Tom stood watch near the far corner of the statue's base, giving Jensen room to be alone. She looked angry, and he looked like he thought it best just to leave her be. Tom looked as if he felt guilty for having been born with the spark of the gift that allowed him to see magic, that same spark possessed by those who had banished people like Jensen.
"Tom," Richard said, "I want you to go with Owen."
Jensen's arms came unfolded as she turned toward Richard.
"Why do you want him to go?"
She suddenly sounded a lot less angry.
"That's right," Owen said. "Why should he go?"
"Because," Richard said,
I want to make sure that you and your men get back here. I need the antidote, remember? The more men I have back here with me who know where it is, the better. I want them safely away from the order for now. With blonde hair and blue eyes, Tom will fit in with your people. If you run into any soldiers from the order, they will think he's one of you. Tom will make sure you all get back here.
But it could be dangerous, Jensen objected.
Richard fixed her in his challenging stare. He didn't say anything. He simply waited to see if she would dare to attempt to justify her objections. Finally, she broke eye contact and looked away.
I guess it makes sense, though, she finally admitted.
Richard turned his attention back to Tom. I want you to see if you can bring back some supplies, and I'd like to use your hatchet while you're gone, if that's all right. Tom nodded and pulled his hatchet from his pack. As Richard stepped closer to take the axe, he started ticking off a list of things he wanted the man to look for. Specific tools. Yew wood. Hide glue. Pack thread. Leather. And a list of other things Kalen couldn't hear. Tom hooked his thumbs behind his belt.
All right. I doubt I'll find it all right off. Do you want me to search out what I can't find before I return?
No. I need it all. But I need those men back here more. Get what's readily available and then get back here with Owen and his men as soon as possible.
I'll get what I can. When do you want us to leave?
Now. We don't have a moment to lose.
Now?
Owen sounded incredulous.
It will be dark in an hour or two.
Those couple of hours may be hours I need, Richard said. Don't waste them.
Kalen thought that he meant because of the poison, but he could have had the gift in mind.
She could see how much pain he was in because of the headache caused by the gift. She ached to hold him, to comfort him, to make him better. But she couldn't make it all just go away. They had to find the solutions. She glanced at the small figure of Richard standing on the base of the statue. Half of that figure was as dark as a nightstone, as dark and dead as the deepest part of the underworld itself. Tom swung his pack up over his shoulder.
Take care of them for me, will you, Kara?
He asked with a wink. She smiled her agreement.
I'll see you all in a few days, then.
He waved his farewell, his gaze lingering on Jensen before shepherding Owen around the statue and toward the man's homeland. Kara folded her arms and leveled a look at Jensen. You're a fool if you don't go kiss him a good journey. Jensen hesitated, her eyes turning toward Richard.
I've learned not to argue with Kara, Richard said.
Jensen smiled and ran over the ridge to catch Tom before he was gone. Betty, at the end of a long rope, scampered to follow after. Richard stuffed the small figure of himself into his pack before picking up his bow from where it leaned against the statue. We'd better get down into the trees and set up a camp. Richard, Kalen, and Kara started down the rise toward the concealing safety of the huge pines. They had been long enough out in the open as far as Kalen was concerned. It was only a matter of time before the races came in search of them, before Nicholas came looking for them. As cold as it was in the pass, Kalen knew they didn't dare build a fire. The races could spot the smoke and then find them. They needed instead to build a snug shelter. Kalen wished they could find a wayward pine to protect and hide them for the night, but she had not seen any of those down in the old world, and wishing wasn't going to grow one. As she stepped carefully on dry patches of rock, avoiding the snow so as not to leave tracks, she checked the dark clouds. It was always possible that it might warm just a little, and that the precipitation could turn to rain. Even if it didn't, it still would be a miserably cold night. Jensen, Betty following behind, returned, catching up with them as they zigzagged down through the steep notches of ledge. The wind was getting colder, the snow a little heavier. When they reached a flatter spot, Jensen caught Richard's arm.
Richard, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be angry with you. I know you didn't banish those people. I know it's not your fault.
She gathered up the slack on Betty's rope, looping it into coils.
It just makes me angry that those people were treated like that. I'm like them, and so it makes me angry.
The way they were treated should make you angry, Richard said as he started away, but not because you share an attribute with them.
Taken aback by his words, even looking a little hurt, Jensen didn't move.
What do you mean?
Richard paused and turned back to her. That's how the Imperial Order thinks. That's how Owen's people think. It's a belief in granting disembodied prestige, or the mantle of guilt, to all those who share some specific trait or attribute. The Imperial Order would like you to believe that your virtue, your ultimate value, or even your wickedness arises entirely from being born a member of a given group. That free will itself is either impotent or non-existent. They want you to believe that all people are merely interchangeable members of groups that share fixed preordained characteristics, and they are predestined to live through a collective identity, the group will, unable to rise on individual merit, because there can be no such thing as independent individual merit, only group merit. They believe that people can only rise above their station in life when selected to be awarded recognition because their group is due an indulgence. And so a representative, a stand-in for the group, must be selected to be awarded the badge of self-worth. Only the reflected light off this badge, they believe, can bring the radiance of self-worth to others of their group. But those granted this badge live with the uneasy knowledge that it's only an illusion of competence. It never brings any sincere self-respect because you can't fool yourself. Ultimately, because it is a counterfeit, the sham of esteem granted because of a connection with a group can only be propped up by force. This belittling of mankind, the order's condemnation of everyone and everything human, is their transcendent judgment of man's inadequacy. When you direct your anger at me for having a trait borne by someone else, you pronounce me guilty for their crimes. That's what happens when people say I'm a monster because our father was a monster. If you admire someone simply because you believe their group is deserving, then you embrace the same corrupt ethics. The Imperial Order says that no individual should have the right to achieve something on his own, to accomplish what someone else cannot, and so magic must be stripped from mankind. They say that accomplishment is corrupt because it is rooted in the evil of self-interest. Therefore, the fruits of that accomplishment are tainted by its evil. This is why they preach that any gain must be sacrificed to those who have not earned it. They hold that only through such sacrifice can those fruits be purified and made good. We believe, on the other hand, that your own individual life is the value and its own end, and what you achieve is yours. Only you can achieve self-worth for yourself. Any group offering it to you or demanding it of you comes bearing chains of slavery. Jensen stared at him for a long moment. A smile finally overcame her.
That's why, then, I always wanted to be accepted for who I was, for myself, and always thought it unfair to be persecuted because of how I was born?
That's why, Richard said. If you want to be proud of yourself because of what you accomplish, then don't allow yourself to be chained to some group, and don't in turn chain other individuals to one. Let your judgment of individuals be earned. This means I should not be hated because my father was evil, nor should I be admired because my grandfather was good. I have the right to live my own life for my own benefit. You are Jensen Rawl, and your life is what you alone make of it. They made their way the rest of the way down the hill in silence. Jensen still had a faraway look as she thought about what Richard had said. When they reached the trees, Kaelin was relieved to get in under the sheltering limbs of the ancient pines, and even more so when they entered the secluded protection of the lower, thicker balsam trees. They made their way through dense thickets into the quiet solitude of the towering trees, and farther down the slope to a place where an outcropping of rock offered protection from the elements. It would be easier to construct a shelter in such a place by leaning boughs against it in order to make a relatively warm shelter. Richard used Tom's hatchet to cut some stout poles from young pines in the understory, which he placed against the rock wall. While he lashed the poles together with wiry lengths of pine roots he pulled up from the mossy ground, Kaelin, Jensen, and Kara started collecting boughs to make dry bedding and to cover over the shelter.
Richard, Jensen asked as she dragged a bundle of balsam close to the shelter,
How do you think you're going to rid Bandikar of the Imperial Order?
Richard laid a heavy bow up high on the poles and tied it in place with a length of the wiry pine root.
I don't know that I can. My primary concern is to get to the antidote.
Jensen looked a bit surprised.
But aren't you going to help those people?
He glanced back over his shoulder at her. They poisoned me. No matter how you dress it up, they're willing to murder me if I don't do as they wish, if I don't do their dirty work for them. They think we're savages, and they're above us. They don't think our lives are worth as much because we are not members of their group. My first responsibility is to my own life, to getting that antidote.
I see what you mean.
Jensen handed him another balsam bow. But I still think that if we eliminate the order there, and this Nicholas, we'll be helping ourselves.
Richard smiled. I can agree with that. And we're going to do what we can. But to help them, I need to convince Owen and his men that they must help themselves.
Kara snorted a derisive laugh.
That will be a good trick, teaching the lambs to become the wolves.
Kaelin agreed. She thought that convincing Owen and his men to defend themselves would be more difficult than the five of them ridding Bandikar of the Imperial Order by themselves. She wondered what Richard had in mind.
Well, Jensen said, since we're all in this, all going to face the Order up in Bandikar, don't you think that I have a right to know everything? To know what you two are always making eyes at each other about and whispering about?
Richard stared at Jensen a moment before he looked back at Kaelin. Kaelin laid her bundle of branches down near the shelter.
I think she's right.
Richard looked unhappy about it, but finally nodded and set down the balsam bough he was holding. Almost 2 years ago, Jagang managed to find a way to use magic to start a plague. The plague itself was not magic. It was just the plague. It swept through cities, killing people by the tens of thousands. Since the firestorm had been started with a spark of magic, I found a way to stop the plague using magic. Kaelin did not believe that such a nightmare could be reduced to such a simple statement and even begin to adequately convey the horror they had gone through. But by the look on Jensen's face, she at least grasped a little bit of the terror that had gripped the land. In order for Richard to return from the place where he had to go to stop the plague, Kaelin said, leaving out terrible portions of the story, he had to take the infection of plague. Had he not, he would have lived, but lived alone for the rest of his life and died alone without ever seeing me or anyone else again. He took the plague into himself so that he could come back and tell me he loved me.
Jensen stared, wide-eyed.
Didn't you know he loved you?
Kaelin smiled a small, bitter smile.
Don't you think your mother would come back from the world of the dead to tell you she loves you, even though you know she does?
Yes, I suppose she would. But why would you have to become infected just to return? And return from where?
It was a place called the Temple of the Winds that was partially in the underworld. Richard gestured up the pass. Something like that boundary was part of the world of the dead, but was still here in this world. You might say that the Temple of the Winds was something like that. It was hidden within the underworld, because I had to cross a boundary of sorts through the underworld. The spirits set a price for me to return to the world of life.
Spirits? You saw spirits there?
Jensen asked.
When Richard nodded, she asked, why would they set such a price?
The spirit who set the price of my return was Dark and Raw.
Jensen's jaw dropped.
When we found Lord Rawl, Kara said, he was almost dead. The Mother Confessor went on a dangerous journey through the Slough, all alone, to find out what would cure him. She succeeded in bringing it back, but Lord Rawl was moments away from death.
I used the magic I recovered, Kaelin said. It was something that had the power to revoke the plague that the magic had given him. The magic I invoked to do this was the three chimes.
Three chimes? Jensen asked.
What are they?
The chimes are underworld magic. Summoning their assistance keeps a person from crossing over into the world of the dead.
Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, at the time I didn't know anything else about the chimes. It turns out that they were created during the Great War to end magic. The chimes are being of sorts, but without souls. They come from the underworld. They annul magic in this world. Jensen looked confused. But how can they accomplish such a thing? I don't know how they work exactly, but their presence in this world, since they are part of the world of the dead, begins the destruction of magic. Can't you get rid of the chimes? Can't you find a way to send them back?
I already did that, Richard said. But while they were here, in this world, magic began to fail.
Apparently, Kalin said, what I began that day, when I called the chimes into the world of life, began a cascade of events that continues to progress, even though the chimes have been sent back to the underworld.
We don't know that, Richard said, more to Kalin than to Jensen.
Richard is right, Kalin told Jensen. We don't know it for sure, but we have good reason to believe it's true. This boundary locking away Bandekar failed. The timing would suggest that it failed not long after I freed the chimes. One of those mistakes I told you about before, remember?
Jensen, staring at Kalin, finally nodded.
But you didn't do it to hurt people. You didn't know it would happen. You didn't know how this boundary would fail, how the Order would go in there and abuse those people.
Doesn't really make any difference, though, does it? I did it. I caused it. Because of me, magic may be failing. I accomplished what the Order is working so hard to bring about. As a result of what I did, all those people in Bandekar died, and others are now out in the world where they will once again do as they did in ancient times. They will begin breeding the gift out of mankind. We stand at the brink of the end times of magic, all because of me, because of what I did.
Jensen stood frozen.
And so you regret what you caused? That you may have done something that will end magic?
Kalin felt Richard's arm around her waist.
I only know a world with magic, she finally said. I became the Mother Confessor, in part to help protect people with magic who are unable to protect themselves. I, too, am a creature of magic. It's inextricably bound into me. I know profoundly beautiful things of magic that I love. They are a part of the world of life.
So you fear you may have caused the end of what you love most?
Not love most, Kalin smiled. I became the Mother Confessor because I believe in laws that protect all people, give all individuals the right to their own life. I would not want an artist's ability to sculpt to be stopped, or a singer's voice to be silenced, or a person's mind to be still. Nor do I want people's ability to achieve what they can with magic to be stripped from them. Magic itself is not the central issue, not what this is about. I want all the flowers, in all their variety, to have a chance to bloom. You are beautiful too, Jensen. I would not choose to lose you either. Each person has a right to life. The idea that there must be a choice of one over another is counter to what we believe.
Jensen smiled at Kalin's hand on her cheek.
Well, I guess that in a world without magic, I could be queen.
On her way by with balsam boughs, Kara said, queens too must bow to the Mother Confessor. Don't forget it.
Chapter 36. Light flooded in as the lid of the box suddenly lifted. The rusty hinges groaned in protest. Of every inch the lid rose. Zed squinted at the abrupt, blinding light of day.